We'll bring the committee to order for today. First of all, Representative Loeffler, will you move the minutes from the last meeting?
Mr. Chairman, I so move.
Any questions on that? All right. Everybody in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The minutes are adopted. We also have some re-referrals. House File 306 is going to be referred to the Mental Health Division. House File 336 is referred to the Licensing Subcommittee. And just a point on that, just so members and the public knows, my intent is that the work on those bills is going to be done in the subcommittee or the division, and that this committee will accept the committee report, but unless there's something radically kind of problematic about it in the way the bill is done, we're just going to move those on to where they need. I'm not planning on doing much work on those bills here. I want to get it done in the subcommittee and division. So if you have interest in those bills, go to those meetings. All right. Well, today we are going to do an overview of our MFIP program, Minnesota Family Investment Program. And the way we wanted to structure this, there's a lot of challenges we face. If you've been in finance in the last couple of days, you've heard about some of the changes in federal law. We need to really rethink a little bit how we do this program. And I thought that the best way to kind of start that discussion is actually hear from the people who are living with the program, kind of both recipients of some of the assistance and people working in the field, so we get a sense of what it means in real people's lives. And, you know, as we think about this over the next month or so and listen to the testimony today and in the future, I hope we keep our eye on the folks, on the fact that the goal of this is to move people, you know, from move people into self-sufficiency. And that's really the ultimate goal here. And it's, you know, there's an importance to kind of making sure our numbers work, but I also think it's really important that we do it in a way that actually serves the purposes of why we have these programs. So with that, we have a lot of people here to testify today. So for members, if you have a specific question about the testimony, please feel free to ask that, but I'd rather have the testifiers be able to talk, and then we'll have lots of time to debate this later. Thanks. The first testifier, and I don't know if it's in this era, but I have Mary Randall. Is that right? Thank you. Go ahead.
I'm Mary Randall. I am from Hayfield, Minnesota. I am a science teacher at Hayfield High School. I do not know where I'd be today if it were not for the help that I've received from MFIP. When I left an abusive marriage, I had a toddler and I was pregnant with a second child. I owned nothing and I wanted nothing but to be safe and to feel safe again. I decided finally to leave my husband and move back into my parents. I considered myself lucky to be able to find a room there where I shared my space with my daughter and my soon-to-be-born son. I found some benefits in MFIP. They provided me with some food stamps and some cash assistance and medical assistance. And I never knew that I could live on so little, but it was all that I needed to feel safe and secure. As I started to recover from the pains and emotional damage of being in an abusive relationship, my depression slowly lifted. As my spirits rose, so did my self-confidence and aspirations. I decided to go back to school, part-time at first, while I cared for my young children. But with children, I knew that I could not stay in my parents' house forever. I had to move on, I had to get out, but I just did not know how. These questions prevented me. These questions presented themselves as a giant barrier. I didn't know how to overcome the situation that I was in. I did have a job at the time, and it did pay pretty well, but it wasn't enough for me to support myself and my children and pay for daycare while I was employed. So I was really starting to lose hope. And I thought everywhere I looked, I saw dead ends, and I felt that many would summarize my situation as the following. My mistake was that I got pregnant at 19, I chose not to abort, and I married an immature, drug-using, and abusive man. And so then my punishment would be for the rest of my life, I would be poor and not able to accomplish anything. A feeling of hopelessness started to creep back into my life. And I wondered if I really was better off in my parents' house when I could have other options, like moving back in with my husband, at least I would have a place again. And he was promising not to abuse me again, so that could be an option. Maybe I could meet a new guy and live with him, and he could help share the bills. But that would be risky too. And maybe I could move into a shelter. It didn't matter where I looked. I just saw kind of dead ends that weren't going to help me. None of the options looked good, so I didn't choose any of them. But thank God for good advice and great programs. My mom suggested that I go back to school. AMSIP was there to help me with that. They supported me while I went to school. I got an AA degree from Century College, transferred to the U of M, got a BS in geology, and then I continued my education with the College of Education and Human Development, and I got a teaching license. From there, I got a job in Hayfield, Minnesota. While I was on the program, I feel like I really accomplished a lot. I was taking 18 credits at times. I was taking physics for science and engineers. I was in the same program as some engineers. And I was taking multivariable calculus, very challenging courses. And I feel like it was really a great opportunity for me to accomplish something and feel great about myself. Had I needed to work on top of all of this, I don't think I would have been able to do it. The goals of having a four-year degree and meeting all of the requirements that I needed to do to get my licensure, I don't think I would have been able to do all of that and raise two children the best that I could if I was also trying to work. And so I was very glad that I was able to enter the program at just the right time to be able to go through school without having to separate my energies and my resources in different directions. I feel like I was very lucky that AMSIP invested in me and I was able to finish my 4-year degree and get a teaching license. I hear now that the program has changed so much that it is impossible for one to get a 4-year degree. It is impossible for them to focus on education because they have to work at the same time. I know lots of people that work and go to school, but they're not single parents. In order to overcome hardships and bad situations, the right way is to invest in oneself, and it takes time. There are no quick fixes. AMSIP is an investment program. It invested in me, and I am a success story. The investment is paying off. I don't understand why anything would be changed that works so well. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Any questions that members have? Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Randall, thinking back, which piece or which part of MPhil you think helped get you to where you are now? I mean, I guess I have an open-ended question.
Okay, Chairman Thiessen and Representative Howe. I would believe that it would be the people that worked with me along the way. They were extremely encouraging. They sort of cheered me on for every class that I passed, for every grade that I earned, and every scholarship that was granted to me. They really supported me, and they said, "You're doing great. Keep up the good work. You're going to be someone someday, and you're just doing a great job." I think it was definitely the people. Of course, it was the services, you know, that they were working through, but it's definitely the people that worked with me.
Representative Bunn?
Chair Thiessen, Ms. Randall, just a real quick question. The number of years it took you to complete your degree once you started going back to school.
Ms. Randall.
Chairman Thiessen and Representative
Bunn, okay.
I can't remember. I actually started college in high school as post-secondary, mm-hmm. and then after I got pregnant, I dropped out. I mm-hmm. stopped for a while, thought maybe being a mom was better for me at the time and just working. Then I started going back, and I think within a year I had my AA. I transferred to the U of M. I got my 4-year degree 2 years later, mm-hmm. and then it was a 15-month program to get my licensure to teach.
Great. Thank you very much.
What?
It's like you made really fast progress and did a terrific job.
Yeah, I did. Mm-hmm. I worked really hard.
And what are you teaching now?
8th grade earth science and 9th grade earth systems and intro to physics.
Anyone else, members? Okay, well, thank you very much for coming down today.
Thank you.
Or coming up, I guess. The next person on the list, well, first of all, we have a new person with us. Do you want to introduce yourself to everybody?
Thanks. My name is Jason Fox, and I'm the new House Republican researcher for the committee.
All right. Welcome.
Thank you.
The next person on the list, Christine O'Brien.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Thank you for having me here today. I'm really nervous, so. I have actually been an MFIP participant for about 4 years now. I've been living in the Jeremiah program for 3 of those years, which some of you don't know. It's a program that started in Minneapolis, which is a nonprofit organization for single mothers who are going to school, who are going to college. Mm-hmm. I have a similar story to Mary. I was married for 3 years to somebody who was in recovery for crack cocaine, and I was an at-home mom, and after 3 years, he relapsed. And I had no education and no work experience and not a lot of support from my family. So I moved into the Jeremiah program, and which was extremely supportive to me. It helped me to learn about healthy relationships and my spending, you know, with money, and taught me a lot about money and parenting with my children, and just helped build me up in my confidence in every area of my life. And but during that time, I also had to comply with MFIP rules and guidelines, which during the time was not really supportive of going to school. I always had to work 20 hours a week in order to go to school, which I did find to be difficult raising two children. I usually would take 2 to 3 classes at a time, but after 3 years, I still hadn't finished my degree. And my caseworker called me and told me that my file had got audited. And I asked her, what does that mean? And she said, well, basically, that means that you're going to need to start working full time. And so, you know, knowing how the system is, I mean, I knew it wasn't her, and it wasn't personal, it was just something I needed to do. I found a job and started working 35 hours a week for XL Energy. But I also needed to comply with the Jeremiah program. So I found a course that would allow me to be certified that I could take on Saturdays, which complied with them. 2 months into working at XL Energy, my job counselor called me again and told me that there was a counselor's aid position open at the American Indian OIC, which was where I was going for to meet with my case manager. And she, I applied for the position, but I also told, or she also told me that there was a counselor position open too. And so I inquired about that, and she said that she would pass the word on to her boss. And so I actually got a call after I turned in my resume and my application for that position. And because of the community leadership experience I got while at the Jeremiah program and in college, and also the education that I did have, allowed me to be qualified for the counselor position. So now I'm actually a frontline worker for the MFIP program also. So that's where that's at. And since that, I mean, that was November the 13th of 2006, the transition from the assistance that I got happened extremely rapidly. I was subsidized assistance in the Jeremiah program, went from $77 a month to $600 a month. My child care co-payment went from $5 to $105, and they cut me off of food support within a month. And the amount of money that I'm talking about is really low, and it seems like it's really affordable, but the low wages that I was receiving and the part-time work that I was doing doesn't really allow me to cover all of that very well. So I would always have to, you know, just be creative and find other resources, and it's you know, it's hard from month to month. So I just try to work hard, and after I get done with my GCEF certification, which is a certification I need to be an employment counselor, I will continue to do online courses or weekend school to get my bachelor's degree. So, thank you.
Thank you. Just and just to clarify, so you got the job with the MFIT program in November,
mm-hmm.
and when you got that job, you lost some of your benefits?
Yes.
Okay. Can you just go through that one more time for
sure.
me? Okay.
Definitely. Sorry about that.
No, not at all. It's
kind of
me.
I got hired November the 13th. I turned my pay stubs in, which you do after every month. And in December, after turning my pay stubs in for November, they told me that my case was suspended. So I did not receive any food support that month. My child care co-payment had already went up from working at XL Energy 35 hours a week, making $9 an hour. And I was in the process of working with Section 8. They took a little bit longer with raising the rent. By January, by this month, I called them and asked them what the status of my case was, assuming that it was closed, and she said, yes, it will be closed as of February 1st. So, which means that I'll be moved into transitional child care, be able to receive child care assistance with the co-payment, adjusted to my income, and no food support, no cash.
Okay, and just to clarify, before, what was your food support and cash assistance?
Cash assistance went to zero as soon as I started working.
And what was it prior?
Oh, I'm sorry, $482.
Okay. And then that includes that was your entire benefit amount?
Or? That was the cash assistance, okay. And then the food support was $352.
Okay. And then you're making what now a month at your MFIP position, if you don't mind me asking this?
No. Actually, I make $12 an hour, and I work 40 hours a week.
All right. Thank you very much. Members, any other questions that people have? President Rood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your testimony and also to the Mary before you. I have a question. If you could just expand a little bit about the Jeremiah program. I'm not familiar with that, and just a little background on that would be helpful.
Chair Thyssen and Representative Rood. The Jeremiah program was started 8 years ago, I think. 9 years ago, by a pastor or a priest over at the Basilica in St. Mary's, or Basilica that's in Minneapolis, and it's a program that is for single mothers that want to get their degree. It's set up kind of like a dorm because you can't have men there, and it's like really security, and you have to sign in, but it's you have your own apartment. So you can have a two-bedroom or a three-bedroom apartment, depending on how many children you have. The children have to be under age 4, 5 when you move in. It has to come. And it's a two-year-long program, and they have a life skills coach that helps you with your goals each month, and they have life skills classes weekly that you attend and resident council that you attend monthly.
Representative Hamilton. Did you have?
Oh, no.
Okay. President Powell.
Thank you. Ms. O'Brien, you lost your cash support right away, right after you start working.
Yeah.
Could that cash support, if you had not lost it, would your transition to where you are, would that have been easier?
Ms. O'Brien?
Yes. Chair Thyssen and Representative Tao. Part of what I was going to say was that I don't mind not receiving assistance anymore, or for cash assistance or food support. Child care costs is the main thing that is very difficult. I was disappointed when I found out that school wasn't encouraged, because both of my parents are college educated, so I know how important it is to get education, and so I was disappointed when I was told that, but the main expense would be child care.
Thank you. Anyone? Well, thank you very much for coming down. That's very helpful. I appreciate it. Brenda Townsville, is that correct? Okay. Thank you. Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Brenda Townsville, and I'm a native of Minnesota. I have 5 daughters who I've raised off and on for about 20 years now with the help of financial assistance. I have never had any problems because it wasn't hard for me, to be honest, working with someone who was willing to help me, especially when I wasn't getting any child support. So when it was time to get help again, I had no problems, except it was kind of hard to look for a job with a certain time limit. Because before MFIP, I was able to go to school and wasn't pressured by the system. Anyway, I was given the opportunity at least get help with finding employment through Goodwill Easter Sales. My employment counselor helped me get connected with the Goodwill store in Hopkins with the supported work experience. And I was able to demonstrate my working ability to get hired. I'm now working at the Goodwill in Hopkins, and I've been successful ever since. It's just having the attitude that I have and not letting my pride get in the way. Thanks for MPHIP. Now I have the opportunity to advance my career and go back to school for some type of medical training. Mm-hmm. That's my story.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
I wanted to not make it so long, and if we do have questions more, I can ask.
No, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Do members have questions? I had a... go ahead, Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Chairman Thiessen. If you had to change anything about the program, something that didn't work well, what would it be?
Ms. Townsville. It's Representative Gottwell.
Representative Gottwell and Chair Thiessen. To be able to go to school and get my training that I really needed so bad before, you know, that just like Christine was mentioning, that the education is what's really what, you know, we really need to be able to have a successful career, you know. And Goodwill Easter Sales is fine. It's a good program, but at the same time, I know I'm going to need more money to raise my children and have a successful career and a job to be able to retire from. So, you're welcome.
Can you talk a little bit more about the demonstrated work experience and what that, a little more detail about what that is? Is that, what?
Yes,
just explain that a little bit
yes,
more.
Chairman Thiessen. Well,
and
my employment counselor is here.
don't hear by me.
And she's welcome to come up as well. It's up to you.
She could actually explain it better.
However you feel. Okay, well, why don't you just, go ahead and tell us a little bit about your experience.
Okay, well, it's through the MPHIP program, and I was able to be a participant through the Goodwill Easter Sales. I was able to get my training, and also get my benefits at the same time before I got hired at Goodwill in Hopkins.
Were you being paid by Goodwill during that time?
Yes.
So you get a wage?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yes.
And then what happens once you get hired full? What's the difference between that time and when you get hired full-time?
Well, when I got hired full-time, Chairman Thiessen, then my benefits did get cut, because I wasn't a participant anymore. I was hired as a full-time employee.
And did your wage go up when you're hired as a full-time employee?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. But then, of course, my benefits got cut.
And just if you don't mind me asking, what was the difference between your wage increase and the reduction in your benefits?
Well,
were you making more or less, I guess?
I made more. But because I am in subsidized housing, I was still able to maintain my my rent and my bills and supporting my children. So it was a little better, but you know, I'm successful and I work hard at the job, so I'm sure I'll be able to advance more, because the managers, they're like me and everything. So, you know, even though it's the Goodwill, it's more into it than just, you know, the retail part of it.
Thank you. Any Representative Tao?
Thank you. Did you, what about health care? Can you explain or tell us a little bit about, did you lose health care as well when you start working full time?
Ms. Tao?
No, sir, Representative Tao, no. No, I still get my health
from the state through NFIP?
Yes, yes. As long
I think the question was for how long,
for how long,
correct?
Yes, for how long.
Yes, Representative as long as I don't go over the guidelines of the MFIT program.
And how much is that?
I'm not sure right now. Because of the wage that I'm at right now, I'm still qualified. So I'm sure after I start getting more raises, and when I stay with the Goodsell in Hopkins, I'm sure that I'll be able to get the benefits through Goodwill.
Representative Murphy.
Representative Towers, my question.
Oh, good. All right. Well, thank you for coming down and talking to us today. I appreciate it. Kim Hosmer?
Hosmer.
Hosmer. Oh, I'm sorry. Wasn't. And Virginia Weldon will be the next witness, so if she could make her way to the table as well. And members, while they're doing that, there's also some additional testimony in the file to take a look at, written submissions. Thank you for coming, Ms. Hosmer.
Thank you for giving us the opportunity.
Sure.
Appreciate it. My name is Kim Hosmer, and I'm here to try to offer a little bit of reality check about what it's like to be on welfare. I went on AFDC before MFIP existed back in 1984 when I found out I was pregnant with my daughter. I'd been attending the U of M, and I had just been laid off from my campus job. I was working in the orthopedic surgery office, and it had been a temporary job, and they hired a full-time secretary, so I was laid off. And when I found out I was pregnant, it was towards the end of the quarter, so I left school at the end of that quarter. And I went to Lutheran Social Services, where I shared a one-bedroom apartment with two other single moms-to-be. As you can imagine, if you've ever been pregnant, you know three cranky pregnant women in a one-bedroom is not a fun thing. Anyway, and during my pregnancy, I worked at the LSS. They got me a little 10-hour-a-week job cleaning the kitchen there. And I applied for AFDC after my daughter was born. I had to stay in a homeless shelter for 2 months while I was looking for affordable housing. And with a grant of only $434, I didn't have very many options. I finally found an apartment in a high-rise that offered Section 8. And for those of you that might not know, Section 8 bases your rent on your income, so that makes it more affordable. It's based on about a third of your income. I struggled to make ends meet on the grant of $434 a month. Out of this meager amount, I had to pay my rent, phone bill, buy diapers, pay for laundry, buy all of my soap, toilet paper, cleaning supplies, etc. And any food beyond the what amounted to about $1 per person per day that we received in food stamps. I was always broke. I was always running out of food before the end of the month and visiting the food shelf every month. I had several part-time jobs through those years, but none were ever permanent or enough to get my family out of poverty. I also had student loans quickly going into default because I couldn't make the payments. In 1986, the grant was raised a whopping 1% from $434 to $437 a month. We celebrated by buying an extra gallon of milk. That was the first and last raise we ever got, and the grant for two people on MFIP today is still $437 a month. For perspective, the cost of living has increased 78% in that same time period. Then in 1996, after several attempts at working, struggling with bouts of depression and a brush with cancer, with my health declining, I learned that Clinton had signed welfare reform legislation as part of the Contract with America. I was terrified. I had been through so much already, and now they were telling me that if I were not able to become totally self-sufficient within 5 years, I would have no income at all for myself or my 11-year-old daughter. By this time, I had tried working, going to community college, and even applied for disability after realizing that no matter how hard I tried, I just could not sustain the pace I needed to get out of poverty. I was denied disability. I appealed and was denied again. At that point, I went to legal aid for assistance, but even after going to the final hearing, I was once again denied. My depression deepened, and I developed anxiety as well, as I feared the fate that awaited me. During my first orientation, the job service worker asked our class, "What should you do if your new boss makes sexual advances towards you?" When one of the women responded that she would report him to a supervisor or file a complaint, the worker replied, "Oh no, you will go back to work to keep your job." Needless to say, I did not remain with that agency. I immediately requested transfer to another agency. But I was not assigned a new job counselor until I was on the waiting list for nearly 6 months. Now that, during that time, welfare reform implemented a 60-month time limit. So already, before I've even got out the starting gate, I've spent one-tenth of my time just waiting to get services. After several attempts to find work with no success, my job counselor referred me to the IRIS program to work on job readiness skills, most of which consisted of working at the computer. I attempted once again to go to school, but my health and depression kept me from being successful. In 1998, I again applied for disability. After many long and agonizing months of doctor visits, physical therapy, various evaluations, and repeated appeals, I was finally awarded SSI of $512 a month in 2000. My daughter's child-only grant at that time was $240. Even though this was still far below the federal poverty guidelines for my family, I felt like a prisoner who had just received a pardon. In the 7 years since I was approved for SSI, I have received a small increase every year. Meanwhile, my sisters on MFIP continue to struggle on the same grants that were in place in 1986. No one should be expected to live under such conditions. I would also like to note that people who are currently on MFIP and receive SSI benefits for any member of their household are subject to a grant cut of $125 per month. And until the law was changed last year, that cut had been per person on SSI. So if you had two parents that were disabled, for example, and had a child on MFIP, normally that child-only grant would be $250. It would have totally eliminated that grant for that family, and they would be getting only food stamps and medical. Many families were facing cuts of $250, $375, or even $500 a month. I hope this helps you to understand the reality of living on welfare and helps you to realize the critical importance of both undoing the cuts and raising the grants this year. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to try to answer them. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hosmer. Any questions that people have for the witness? Okay, thank you for coming down.
Sure.
And maybe if you want to, you may want to stay there. There might be questions that come up
sure.
after Ms. Weldon goes as well. Go ahead.
Hello, my name is Virginia Weldon. I'm also with the Welfare Rights Committee. I'm a recent recipient of MFIP and a mother of two. I was working at a job for over 3 years, but because of surgery and medical condition that I still am suffering from, I was forced to leave my job. I needed to go on welfare in order to support my family. While on MFIP, I was a victim of domestic violence from my husband. Because of the domestic violence situation, I was exempt from doing job search until 2001. After the exemption ended, I started doing job search. This is about the same time that the recession hit. So I was competing with many others who needed jobs. After 6 months, I had no success finding any work. So I went to a month-long training program to upgrade my skills in administrative support. The day I graduated from the training program, myself and my youngest child were evicted from our apartment unfairly in retaliation for reporting serious maintenance problems involving water damage and mold growth. So my son and I were put into the streets and had to go to a homeless shelter for about 5 weeks. After getting out of the homeless shelter, I found an apartment and resumed my job search. During all of this crisis, I was also suffering from spinal damage and having to go to therapeutic pool therapy 2 times a week every week. I continued doing job search from February until May of 2002. I spent 20 to 40 hours a week doing job search, sending applications, and had only one or two interviews from my efforts and only rejection letters. In June of 2002, I went to a two-month training program to get more technical skills. And when I completed that, I started looking for a job again. I continued extensive job search and sent applications but did not find a job. I then took a training program for banking skills. After I graduated, I again started extensive job search for an average of 30 hours a week and have been doing this through early 2005. Again, I was not accepted for any job, was given only one interview, and only received rejection letters. During this time, while I was dealing with severe medical problems, domestic violence, homelessness, joblessness, and living in poverty, my son and I were trying to survive on a cash grant from Imprint of $437 a month. The welfare is only a survival check. It is not something to be able to do anything beyond surviving, like doing anything enjoyable with my son. And it really was not enough to even survive. It sucked. If my son had activities or events at school, I didn't have the money to pay for them. I couldn't afford a household phone. To use the phone, I had to bus to Walgreens to get a prepaid card, and then every time I needed to use the phone, I had to walk 3 blocks to the nearest pay phone. When you are already living in poverty, you are already living in crisis. If you have an emergency, you can't call 911. You can't look for a job easily because you have no phone. After paying rent and utilities, and I have subsidized rent, if I had any money left after the first week of the month, it was less than $100. And that was supposed to last me and my child for the rest of the month. I still needed to buy household cleaning products and personal hygiene products. Part of that money was to be used to buy food to supplement the food stamps, which aren't enough to last a month. I had to take a bus to get to the grocery store, and when I had to, I had to spend money on a taxi to get the groceries home. It's hard to even find the money to pay for the bus ride to get anywhere. The convenience stores that are within walking distance charge triple the amount for food that the big stores do, but we often end up paying it because we can't get to the bigger stores. Then in 2003, because of welfare cuts passed by Minnesota politicians, my son and I had $50 a month cut in the infant grant because we had subsidized housing. So then we were trying to survive on $387 a month. Tell me how anyone in Minnesota thinks a family can survive on this little money, and why, when the state was in deficit, were they taking money away from our kids who are already just barely surviving? Next, in March of 2005, I was forced to work for free for over 5 months in order to receive my infant grant of $387 a month. My primary doctor stated 3 times with 3 different infant forms that I was not able to work because of multiple internal injuries, but I was still forced to work for no pay. My job counselor threatened me with sanctions to my welfare grant and told me that I had to do volunteer work because I couldn't find paid employment, like it was my fault that I couldn't get a job. I was forced to work 33.75 hours per week, which added up to 135 hours a month. I was getting a welfare grant of $387 a month. If you divide 387 by 135 hours, this means I was only making $2.86 an hour if I was actually getting paid. But in fact, I was forced to work for free just to get a tiny welfare grant. I was working as an administrative support person for a nonprofit, which I should have been paid no less than $10 an hour. To add insult to my injuries, after over 5 months of working for no pay, I reached my welfare limit. I was working for the place that hired me, and actually the place that actually hired me had, they put this little, game or whatever you want to call it, saying, oh, well, you're a good person, you know, we thank you for this, we thank you for that. But when my time limit was up because my child had turned 18 years old, they let me go. And before they let me go, they made sure that I knew that there was another person who was going to do my job with pay that they had hired. Now, I mean, after over 5 months, don't you think they should have had offered me the job instead of just saying, well, you don't have a car, so, you know, we're going to give it to somebody else. And this person was only doing it for part-time, but yet she was getting paid. And the same way I got to the place that I was working at is the same place I would have got to if I was getting paid by them. So that was no excuse. This is a degrading, discriminatory situation I was forced to do just so I could get an infant grant. This is a slave labor for any poor and working families on welfare. This is a clear example of how this brutal so-called welfare reforms and workfare are not about ending poverty. They are about pushing poor women into free labor or low-wage labor and trapping us into poverty for life. And also I have something else to say real quick. Even though I was doing this, even though I was doing these 33.75 hours per week, my job counselor expected me to search for a job on top of that, and then on top of that, I was going to physical therapy. So that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Members, any questions? Well, I had a couple of questions. First, on the job search that you were doing, can you talk a little bit more about how you did you go someplace to do that since you didn't have a phone, and how did all of that work?
Yes, I did. Usually I would go to, I went to 5 different locations. I went to the South Minneapolis Workforce Center on Lake Street. I went to Sabathany Life Skills department they have downstairs. I went to Walker's Library. I went to Calvary Baptist Church where they had... they had, like, computers there, too. And basically, I just went where I could, you know, even the Central Library downtown Minneapolis or the Hosmer Library, anywhere I could go where there was a computer. I even, you know, got the employment news, employment guys, the career builders, anything that I could get my hands on to just to try to get employment. And I even tried to settle for minimum wage job, and I still did not get accepted. So there was just no excuse. I mean, I wasn't sitting at home, and I mean, if I would have sat at home, regardless if I had these internal injuries or not, as mean and as cruel as I was treated, I would have got sanctioned, without a doubt, you know. And like I said before, I have testified in front of the House of Representatives and the Senate, and I did bring all my proof in. Of the job searches that I did. I even went to job clubs, you know, and still that didn't do any good.
And can you talk a little bit of what kind of jobs you were applying for?
I was applying for anything from cashiering all the way up to administrative support. Legally, I should be making, with my credentials, I should be making at least $15, at least, at this day and time. But because I have these internal injuries, and I did try to apply for SSI several times, I've been applying for SSI since 1999, and I keep getting denied. So there's just, like I said, there's just no excuse for the system to be this cruel and brutal to a woman who's trying to make it.
Representative Ruth.
Mr. Chair, thank you for your testimony. I just have a question. During all this period, were you able to collect any child support?
Yes, I got child support, but you know what? That really doesn't have anything to do with my workfare, and I collected child support, but the amount that I had collected, they took out of the infant grant, so it was like it was still the equivalent of $387, and actually, you know, that was a child support that I didn't get on a regular basis. So,
when the state collects child support, they pay themselves.
That's
they
right.
Don't pay us. That if you're a father paying child support, your ex-spouse is on MFIP, that child is not paying any more money than they would if you were not paying child support. The only people making more money is the state, because they're getting reimbursed for the grant.
Thank you very much. I did have one more question, and that are you done? I'm sorry. Your son? Mm-hmm. What is he? He's 18. Well, 18.
Well, he turned 18, and that's why we got cut off the infant.
Is he? What is he doing now?
Right now, he's working for Walmart in Midway, and they had cut him off of. They cut him off of everything. He didn't get any medical or anything. And when they did cut him off, you know, they didn't do it legitimately, because if they did, then they would have known that he could not get medical until he worked so many months at Walmart. And then when Walmart does give you medical, it's either little to nothing at all. Mm-hmm. So they did him very badly as well as me. So
They didn't allow him to get Minnesota Care or MA because Walmart was supposedly offering him health insurance?
No, he wasn't getting health insurance when they had cut us off when he turned 18 years old. He wasn't getting any kind of medical at all. You know, he had to work so many months for them until a year, I guess, or whatever, before they even offered him any kind of medical. And the medical that they do offer him is not that great. So.
Well, thank you very much for coming down today and testifying for us.
Thank
it's
you.
Very helpful. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
The next testifier is Shane Olson. Is Shane here? Oh, they're right in front of me. Okay. And then Mary Cabasso is next, so that would like to come up. Thank you. Ms. Olson.
Thank you, Chairman Bison. I could not have followed a better person than Virginia, because I myself am an employment counselor and infant social worker for Olmsted County. And Virginia is not isolated in the issues that she's facing and the struggles that as employment counselors we are facing. Kind of to give you a little bit of background, you know, I also am an AMFIP recipient, or I'm sorry, an AFDC recipient. So I was on welfare for 10 years as a single parent. Through education, before the education guidelines came into play, I was able to achieve my bachelor's degree and then turn around and be able to serve AMFIP participants. You know, the program has changed, as we all are hearing over and over again, as far as education, and that's kind of an issue. But as an employment counselor, you know, I think the most significant thing that we are witnessing is that there is a gap between the legislation and policies that we are required to follow to distribute MFIP. In other words, what we are requiring participants to do to be able to be what's called compliant to get their funds. We are requiring families, depending on the family size, to participate in job search activities, employment, etc., between 20 to 35 to 40 hours per week. When what we're learning is when you live in poverty, life is a whole lot harder than when you're not. Some of those examples or some of the main areas that I've seen in my position and one that Virginia hit on is time. Everything takes a whole lot more time when you are poor. You've heard people give testimony about how they didn't have enough money to pay their rent, etc. They had to go find resources. They had to walk down the block, knock on a neighbor's door to make a phone call. Imagine job searching 35 hours a week, all the calls that you have to make. You don't have internet access in your home. You don't have a telephone. You don't have a vehicle. When I was preparing to come and speak with you today, I made a call to our local bus company, asked them the route, told them I lived in a location and I needed to get to this other location, which was my employment, and I needed to stop along the way and drop my children off at daycare. It was a 12-mile trip. It took a total, both before and after, of 3 hours and 20 minutes of transportation time. Poverty costs time. Mm-hmm. By having income, we have conveniences and accessibility to be able to minimize that time to balance the needs of our family. When you're in poverty, you do not. One thing that is also significant with that, as an employment counselor, the legislation right now has us documenting time. Everything is tracking on hours, and you've heard people comment about that. We ask them to report. Now it's changed from weekly basis to a daily basis. They need to come to our office to drop off what's called job logs, telling us what they did throughout the day, okay? So we're having them do all these activities, and we are not being able to count time that is spent for, like, transportation. We're not able to count the time that you walked over to your neighbors and talked to them for 10 minutes so that you could be nice, so that you could use the phone to make that call. Things like that, the legislation right now, when we go to put the policies into play as employment counselors, they are not matching. They are not matching. And as Virginia commented, no matter, I think it was something along her employment counselor being mean. Right now, if the counties do not sanction a participant that is not doing the required amount of hours, our county is penalized. We lose money to be able to serve our participants. So if somebody is not meeting those requirements and we do not sanction them, our funding will be affected and we cannot serve them. Do you see the cycle? That kind of seems not to be productive of achieving that bottom line of self-sufficiency. Another thing that I also notice and have experienced personally is a lack of reliable natural supports. I have friends, you know, that are kind of in the same situation I have. They have the same resources. We all assimilate to who, you know, we are. When you're in poverty, your friends and family are often in the same place. They often do not have the same time to provide those natural supports, and they also don't have the resources to borrow you $20. And that $20 is huge when you're living it. It's huge. The other thing also is resources. I was driving up here today. I'm going, you get all nervous. Well, maybe, you know, I hear a putt-putt in my car. Whoops, can't make it. I could, if my car broke down on the way up here, tell me, within a half an hour, I could not figure out a way to get back on track to get here. When you are living in poverty, if you are still fortunate enough to have that $250 car where you could see the bottom of the street and have a screwdriver to start it, I've been there. If you are fortunate to have one of those, if a breakdown occurs, if anything happens, you don't have those backup resources that when you're not in poverty, you do. Today I could pull out a credit card. Today I could call a friend that would be able to have vacation time so that they could come and help me. Understand that simple things take a lot of time when you're in poverty, and the way legislation is set up right now, it is not reasonable. We need to figure out some sort of way to make that match. Kind of some examples here that I listed, I gave you as far as the bus route. By the way, I didn't...
Ms. Bolton, just so we can move to some other testifiers, and this is really good, but as fast as you can, continue, but
absolutely.
Thank you.
Okay. Just a couple examples, too, that seem to not be matching up I mentioned the job log, 6-week assessment. Once a year or every year, participants have 6 weeks to be able to job search, to be able to address any CD issues, to be able to address any counseling, mental health, etc. If they go over that 6-week timeline, they then are considered to be non-compliant. And then the other thing that I have listed here is the education, which I think you've heard over and over again. I'm here today because there was not the policies in place to where I was able to get my education. On today's program, I would not have got my bachelor's, and I think that's pretty significant. So just kind of, you know, on an ending point, while you guys are looking at developing the policies and how you're going to implement them, just, you know, I can't encourage you enough to make sure that they're fitting in the reality of people living in poverty. We're punishing them, which is making the challenges go up higher in some cases. So thank you.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Shumper.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Shane. Two specific things that you'd like changed, if we could change them, or that we should change.
Education. Currently, you can only do a one-year program, and you have to work 20 hours per week while you are going into college. You can't be a good parent at the end of the day at all. I don't even know if the hours would be doable. The other thing would be more flexibility as frontline workers to be able to fit plans to the individual with accountability. So if a goal is set up, if the goals are set up, we need to be able to look at the barriers. We need to be able to look at the transportation. If it's that somebody's working 30 hours a week, but they're in transportation for 15 hours per week, we want to be able to count that because they are working for self-sufficiency.
Thank you very much. Ms. Cabasso.
Sure.
Is that the correct?
Yes. Okay. My name is Mary Cabasso, and I'm employed with as a vocational counselor with Hennepin County, Human Services, Public Health Department, Work Support Division. I've been with Hennepin County since the year 2000. I was hired at a time in 2000 when Hennepin County put in a unit of vocational rehabilitation counselors to work with a group of people who were already being deemed hard to employ. And that was on the existing MFIP program. I then worked with Tier 2 services, which was funded with extra money to work for the hard to employ. And currently I'm working with extension cases, which are the people who are extended post 60 months because of disability. I started doing that in 2003. In addition to a small caseload that I work with right now, I also work with as a work support representative for another program that we're doing at Hennepin County, which coordinates services. It's called the Fusion for Families, between child protection, the eligibility support, which are the people who process the money, shelter team, emergency assistance, multicultural services, and any other Hennepin County workers that they're working with. And this program meets with the client at the time the children are being reunified into the home, so that we can facilitate that they're going to have a smooth transition with the money in place, the work support plan in place, and everything going to keep that family together. The other thing that I do for Hennepin County is I also work as a monitor, auditor, auditing service provision for the other employment service providers in Hennepin County. Currently, with the hard-to-employ extension cases, there are about 130 extended cases in Hennepin County under hard-to-employ extension. For the post-60-month cases, there has to be a diagnosed reason for extension, whether it be mental health, low IQ, learning disabilities, mental retardation. These conditions must impact their ability to either obtain or maintain employment. In addition, many have other barriers, including no or limited work experience, no work references, no high school diplomas or GEDs, criminal backgrounds, current court actions that are going on. Many can't pass drug screenings that employers require. Some are on probation, and they're also working with child protection, or they're working with other social service units within the county. Needless to say, the group that I worked with, the hard-to-employ extension cases, none of them are meeting the federal participation rate, and we've not been able to meet the federal participation rate for that group forever since I've been doing it. When I was out monitoring with the other employment service providers, even though they're, you know, we look at the case files for are they contacting their clients, or are they bringing in the documentation, are they, you know, doing the basic case management things, the files are looking great, and still they're all, or not all, but a lot of them are saying they're having a lot of difficulty getting clients to meet that federal participation rate as it's now 50%. So as the number of MFIP participants in Hennepin County decreases, and with universal participation being required, which used to exempt some people from participation, We've been developing modified plans so that we can incorporate the social service, mental health, clinical health activities into their plan to move them ahead. However, those social service plans do not count towards accountable activities. And basically, I wanted to give you kind of two examples of cases that I actually worked with and how the activities didn't count. In September 2005, I started working with a two-parent family, three children. She was extended on mental health issues. She had initially come through the Fusion for Families program and was recovering from a 10-year methamphetamine addiction. She dropped out of school in seventh grade. She had not worked since 2000. She's diabetic, and she was on medication for her diabetes. She also has an old drug felony. Her initial plan incorporated a child protection plan, which included mental health counseling, chemical dependency, treatment aftercare. She had to have urine analysis twice a week that were court-ordered. She had to attend a minimum of two Narcotics Anonymous meetings a week. She was in family therapy. She was in personal therapy. She was getting in-home parenting services. And she was medically monitoring her diabetic condition as well. The total hours that she needed to do those things was 34 hours of activity, and that's what was written into her plan. None of those activities are countable in terms of participation rates. By January of 2006, the other parents had left the grant. He wasn't there anymore. He wasn't doing as well as she was. Her above-listed activities had dropped to 24 hours, and we added 10 hours of job search to her plan. That was not enough job search to count toward participation rate. Still, it was part of her plan, and she's a very cooperative person. By April, she secured employment. She was working as a seasonal line worker for concessions at a stadium, and she could be scheduled up to 30 hours a week, and it was averaging about 28 hours a week. And she continued in the social service activities, and they had dropped down to about 14 hours a week. So at that point, what counted is she was working, she was maintaining at least 87 hours a week. Those were countable activities that were toward participation rate. The other activities in her plan didn't count, but that's okay. We already had the core work activities in there. However, her job was going to be ending because it was at a stadium and it was seasonal. Luckily, she, by November 1st, had secured another job at a coffee house, 28 hours a week. She finished two more days at the stadium, and she still continues to have about 14 hours of social services and dental appointments because of the methamphetamine addiction. She has the teeth that you all see on TV. So there were many months we couldn't count her activities toward participation rate, but these services actually are helping her get to work, get stabilized, build a work history. The second example, I was assigned to...
Okay, and just quickly on the second one, if we could.
Actually, the second one's longer.
Sorry.
So I'm going to jump away from that one. Actually, it's a person where you can't count if they come in with minimal disability, didn't have the same amount of barriers, but didn't participate. When we did the first plan of 30 hours of job search, he did nothing. Those hours do not count. And then the sanctions are imposed. And he went through three sanctions, and kind of went through that process. And that whole process, again, it doesn't count if they're not making or trying to meet those hours. And he did not need all those social service activities. Okay, then my other little point is, when I was going through this whole information and the regarding participation rates and how it's affecting, because the number of people on MFIP is decreasing, but we're seeing much more need for these modified work plans where people do need the social services or they do need the chemical health, mental health, whatever services, so that they can be in the best position so that they can get to work. Those hours aren't counted, and it's affecting our plan. My only other comment had to do, I looked at a Department of Human Services publication on breaking down who's on MFIP by racial and cultural group, or by racial group and by education levels. And actually, the Hennepin County statistics on who we're serving look a whole lot different than the rest of the state. The state's publication indicates about 43% of MFIP participants are white. Hennepin County is 21%. For the black, which would be African American and the African immigrant population, they're not split apart in our count. For Hennepin, or for the state, it's 35%. For Hennepin County, it's 65%. American Indian for the state, it's 9%. 6% for Hennepin County. Asian, 8%. 7% for Hennepin County. 5% Hispanic for the state, and we have such a marginal, it's less than 1% in Hennepin County. So we're kind of seeing a different population. We're also seeing a lower level of, or a higher amount of no high school diplomas in Hennepin County than the state is. So I guess our conundrum at this time, we do feel some people are moving to Hennepin County because we do have the services there for people to access. We have shelter services, we have multicultural services, chemical health, mental health, a whole spectrum of services. But, you know, hopefully they will, by providing those services, we'll be able to get them employed and get them self-sufficient. But in the interim, they do not count.
All right. Well, thank you for coming and for all the work that you do, too.
Okay,
Ms. Hanley.
Yes.
Thank you. And please identify yourself for the record and let us know where you're from, too.
Okay, sure. Thanks for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Mary Hanley, and I'm an occupational therapist and social worker with Ramsey County. I have worked for 5.5 years with long-term MFIP recipients who are 48-plus months. So I work with people in their last month of MFIP and also with people who have been extended with their benefits. What I do is I assess participants' eligibility for hardship extensions. I also do in-home functional assessments of the participants who are long-term, and I connect disabled MFIP recipients with other services that are necessary for them to live in the community. Here are some things that I've learned about these families. All the participants I have assessed have a goal of working, and most have had several work attempts, but they have been unable to keep jobs because of the multiple barriers they face, and they've been unable to attain self-sufficiency. Lack of education and training lead to part-time employment for people and entry-level jobs with no benefits, and these jobs are easily lost when crises arise. Participants don't easily disclose their learning problems or mental illness to their job counselors or acknowledge them even to themselves. Between 60 to 85% of people that we sanctioned for noncompliance in Ramsey County were later found to be disabled or caring for a disabled family member. Long-term families represent a small number of MFIP participants. 75% of participants leave assistance within 24 months. Typical screening tools that we use in MFIP and even more thorough psychological assessments don't uncover all the issues that our clients have. It's essential to assess participants' daily functioning in their home setting in order to uncover the issues that they're dealing with. And many of the participants that I've worked with and their family members are eligible for Social Security benefits, but they are unable to obtain these benefits themselves without assistance. And I think you've heard some of those stories today. Previously, I worked at Ramsey County as a therapist with people with serious and persistent mental illness. I did that for 16 years before coming to MFIP. I worked in an employment program for people with mental illness, and my clients enjoyed a pretty high level of success in getting and finding jobs, and they were able to keep their jobs for a long period of time with the services that we provided for them. I came to MFIP thinking that everybody can work, and that was sort of my gung-ho attitude when I came in. And even despite mental illness and cognitive issues, all of that. But the people that I worked with at Ramsey County Mental Health Clinic had a safety net income of SSI to support them while they attempted to succeed in employment. They also had diagnoses, treatment, and other types of services, case management services, things like that, that are available to the disability population. I wasn't prepared when I came to MFIP for the number of people I was meeting who had serious mental illness and serious cognitive impairment. And I wondered, why aren't these people on SSI? It was just really surprising to me. In most cases, the people that I was seeing were more symptomatic and less stable than the clients I had worked with at the mental health clinic. And they weren't receiving any of the treatment or services that I thought were warranted in their situations. I still believe that everyone can work. However, I now believe that in order for people to be successful, they need to be diagnosed, treated, and have access to the necessary support services. We must have good policies in place in order to support them as they struggle with their multiple barriers that confound their efforts. While I don't see SSI income as an end goal, I do see SSI income as an important safety net to support clients while they achieve self-sufficiency, and also as an entry to other services that are rehabilitative in nature that the disability community receives. I have some startling numbers to share with you that I hope you'll take time to read. I won't read them. It's a list of 1,360 current hardship extensions in Ramsey County programs that, and our program requires that we select only one primary reason for extension. These numbers reflect the primary reason for extension for the people on this caseload. However, three-fourths of the participants on my caseload have several reasons for extension. For instance, a person with a low IQ may also have mental illness, domestic violence in the home, be caring for special needs children, all at the same time, and the numbers that I've given you don't reflect that. In closing, I want to share just briefly about a home visit I went on last week. I visited a woman with three children who was closed in December, her 60th month. She was a transfer from an outer Minnesota county, and the paperwork for her extension wasn't completed before she moved. She had had to move suddenly because of domestic violence in her home and a fear of being found by the perpetrator of that violence. The person who had perpetrated the violence in the family was her partner, who had kidnapped her two-year-old at gunpoint. She had managed to get her child back and showed me an order for protection. She also had an individual individual education plan for her 11-year-old daughter, who has developmental disability. Also, her daughter has a physical condition, the same daughter, that has required 9 surgeries to date. She's 11 years old. Her medical care has been disrupted by the move, and now she is looking for new medical providers for her daughter for the next surgery that's necessary. The mother's treatment for PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, and depression was also disrupted by the move, and I had to refer her for some services so that she could get her medication that is necessary for her to function in her household. While we were talking, she told me she's had several jobs, but for short periods of time. She's missed several more permanent job opportunities because she's been unable to pass the necessary entrance exams to take those jobs. This made me suspect that she has some learning problems, and we haven't delved into that yet. While I was there, her landlord called and said if she didn't give the rent within the next day or two, she was going to be evicted. She's had no income, food stamps, or medical coverage this month because of the transfer in her 60th month. The remarkable thing about these circumstances is that it's not unusual. Every day I'm emotional about this because it's so disturbing to me, but every day I meet families that are working on obstacles such as these. These families deserve our compassion and a service plan that addresses their needs. It is heartbreaking that they internalize society's messages about lazy welfare participants when nothing could be further from the truth. I hope you will take this information into consideration while making decisions that affect these vulnerable families.
Thank you very much for coming down and sharing your experience. Mr. Hester, thank you. And again, please identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Al Hester. I'm with the Public Housing Agency in St. Paul. And I'm speaking on behalf of the Minnesota chapter of NARO, which is the National Association of Housing and Redevelopment Officials. Tom Streitz, Deputy Director of Minneapolis Public Housing, is also here. NARO represents most of the public housing agencies in the state. And we're here to talk very briefly about a very narrow part of MFIP. Virginia Weldon already introduced the topic, and I thank her for that. We refer to it as the MFIP housing penalty. When the folks were putting together Minnesota's welfare reform package in 1997, they were looking for cutting corners, saving money wherever they could, and somebody said, hey, why don't we cut grants to people who live in public housing or have Section 8 vouchers? We can save some money that way. It's about the money. That's really all it is. It was put off for several years by action of the legislature. It was in the law, but it was delayed, and it finally went into effect at $50 a month starting in 2003, I believe. So every MFIP recipient who lives in public housing or has a Section 8 voucher gets $50 less each month in their check. And if they're on SSI, somebody else mentioned, they get $125 more cut out of their check. I think one of the unintended consequences of that was taking money not just away from the family, but away from our affordable housing system. Because the way the federal laws work for rent payments, if someone receives Section 8 or public housing assistance, when the rent goes down by $50, when their income goes down, their rent also goes down. So they're paying less in rent to our public housing agencies. And those numbers add up. We are estimating it's about $1.3 million a year that's taken out of the affordable housing system. It's taken out of Section 8, and it's taken out of public housing. Now, those two have somewhat different effects. Vouchers, the Section 8 system's a closed system. So if you have less money, you have to pay more subsidy for each voucher. You just can't issue as many. And we're not sure of the numbers. I do have a handout that summarizes this, if someone could pass it around for me.
Please, thank you.
It's pretty straightforward. We think it's at least 150 vouchers statewide that we can't issue because of the MFIP housing penalty. In Minneapolis alone, it looks like it's at least 35. In St. Paul, it's at least 25. Those aren't huge numbers, but they're folks that aren't getting that deep subsidy housing assistance that is so valuable. Our housing, Section 8 housing assistance list, waiting list, has been closed since November of 2002. And here we have 25 vouchers that potentially we could issue, but we can't because of this penalty. It's important to note, too, it's not just people on MFIP that are paying that penalty, because 60% of residents of public housing are elderly and disabled households. So, again, unintended consequences. I think that MFIP housing penalty is taking money away from the housing system. We need to support the other folks as well. On the public housing side, we can't save money by shutting down units. In fact, some of our agencies are looking at selling units because we're getting less money from the federal government. But we have to cut it someplace. It comes out of maintenance. It comes out of management. We simply have to make do with the rents we collect. The federal government is not increasing its subsidies. It's cutting them right now. But that's pretty much the summary. It is a statewide issue. There are 144 housing authorities across the state serving at least 200 communities, because sometimes one agency has many of them. There are 21,000 public housing units, 30,000 Section 8 vouchers, and all of them share the cost of this $50 penalty to MFIP recipients. Pardon me. I can't add much to the powerful personal stories folks already told, but this is an equally important one to us because the state's now looking at ways to put a little more money into affordable housing. We applaud that. Here's a way to plug a leak that's been going for a couple of years and is sucking more than $1 million a year out of the system.
Thank you very much for coming on and talking to us about that. Any questions on that, members? Thank you. I appreciate it. Now, Susan? Oh, Jim Abler. Sorry, Representative Abler.
I was just going to ask how much, I signed a bill to repeal it, but what does that cost to repeal it? Is it a couple $1 million, you know?
And Representative Abler, I haven't gotten the fiscal note, but I think it's in the range of $2.5 million for the biennium. So
and with the backfill of 1.3, it's really about a net 1.5.
Thank you. Assistant Commissioner Johnson, if we could get started with kind of this overview. And I'm sorry to leave you with so little time. But I think a lot of people were here yesterday as well for your presentation. So, again, I apologize. And we can probably go for about 12 or 13 minutes.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Chuck Jones with the Department of Human Services. I'm just going to do a brief introduction, and Ann Sessions will actually take you through the more detailed presentation. So while she's getting the things set up, I'll just give you a brief introduction. First of all, thank you, Mr. Chair, for having this hearing and for bringing the perspectives of the participants in MFIP and the people who are working in the front line. I think that's very helpful for everybody in terms of starting out the session and looking at what we're going to be doing with this program. As you know, with the Deficit Reduction Act changes, there will be a lot of discussion on MFIP this year. That is both an opportunity to address those changes. It's also an opportunity to address other issues within MFIP, take the opportunity where we can to bring those two things together and try to keep us on what we think has been a reasonably successful track in Minnesota in welfare reform. I'd encourage you, as you listen to Ann's presentation, to pick up two things that I think you also heard from the previous testimony and two areas of welfare that we've learned about through welfare reform that I think we need to keep working on. One is that we have a lot of folks who transition off the program quite quickly, quite successfully, but that isn't sort of the end of the story for them. Low-income working families need a lot of other assistance in child care, through health care, the tax system, wherever, in order to have stable lives and not end up coming back on to MFIP and so forth. And I think that's part of the bigger system that is not just welfare reform per se, but is really about the low-income working families. Secondly, you heard quite a bit about the that subgroup within the MFIP population who faces real significant challenges in their lives toward finding work, disabilities, illnesses, and family violence and so forth that's affecting them. That has been a real challenge, as you heard from the last set of testifiers, people who work in the field, to serve those families. And we're continuing to work on that, but that continues to be a challenge for us. And I think that I hope there's an opportunity this year for us to continue to look at how we improve our services to those families as well. How, as I mentioned yesterday, how we tailor service to be more appropriate to what our needs are. And I would also throw into that mix that was discussed a little bit, the disparity issue. And Anne will talk some of that. We don't do as well in our outcomes for African-American and American Indian families. And that's something we're working on. It's something the counties are working on. But it continues to be a challenge for us to figure out how we can do a better job of serving those families, which is our tradition in Minnesota, to try to serve everyone as best we can. So with that, I'm going to turn over to Anne and let her take you into the beginning of the presentation.
Thank you. Please identify yourself for the record, if you could.
Yeah, Anne Sessoms, Department of Human Services. And given the time, yes, I'm going to move through some of the first slides really quickly. Okay.
Thank you.
So, and I know there are a number of new members, and so that's why we tried to do some basics here. So MFIP has the three identified goals of expecting, supporting, and rewarding work. And
And Ms. Sessoms, we did send out kind of a overview brief, so hopefully members will have a little bit of background in this.
Okay.
So.
Okay. And you have heard about these different pieces, I think, today. You've heard that employment plans are expected, that people who are on MFIP who look for work and get work are child care is covered, there's food support, health care is generally included. And the reward part of work for MFIP is that individuals get, when they have earnings, they get to have a certain portion of those earnings disregarded. There's a portion that's disregarded off the top and then 38% of their gross income. The employment plan is the expecting part of the work, and as you heard today, almost everyone on MFIP has an employment plan. The plan can be, it can include social service activities that you heard about from some of the job counselors today. Under the federal regulations, those activities don't help us meet the federal targets. The activities are, and the plans are, to meet what the participant can do, and the plan also varies based on the age of the child. I think you heard some of that. If the children are under 6 years old, there are fewer hours that are required than there are when the kids get a little bit older. As I said, when people go to work, they, depending on the income, the family may still receive MFIP, and they may still receive cash, or they may just receive food. Minnesota's program is unique in the country. There is no other welfare program that has the cash and food combined like we do. And the benefit that we believe comes from that is that both for participants as well as administratively for agencies. And that's because when people have earnings and their earnings fluctuate, one month they may only get food, and then if the earnings go down, they go back into cash. And in other states, that would require an entirely new application process and dealing with the agency, whereas in Minnesota, people can go back and forth, and as long as until they exit the food altogether, they still have the package of benefits. There are two grant standards, so that if you go to work, your earnings are compared against the higher amount, and then there's the 38% income disregard. You've also heard a lot today about the time limits on MFIP. That was instituted starting in July of 1997 with federal welfare reform. It's 60 months or 5 years. The federal law allows states to extend some families beyond the 60-month limit, and our state law is very specific about who may be extended and how those extensions are granted. There are also certain circumstances where something is called stopping the clock, and even though you're receiving benefits, they aren't counted at that time. We've only listed two of them here. There's a couple others, but for the most part, 18 and 19-year-olds who choose to continue their education, are the clock does not count, and families that are notified the agency that they have domestic violence issues, and they have a waiver for that. Sanctions are also part of MFIP. A sanction happens when an individual has an employment plan and they are determined to not be cooperating with the plan. The grant gets reduced, and the pre-60-month sanctions start at 10%. 10% the first instance, which is a month, and it moves to 30%, and then at the end of 6 months, it's 100%. The case is closed. If the family, if the caregiver comes back into compliance, they can come back on in the pre-60 months. Sanctions are a little bit different in the post-60 months, and one of the one of the changes on the budget page that you saw relates to a proposal of the governor's to shorten the sanction period and to align the pre and post 60 months sanctions. You'll also hear about the diversionary work program, and I have to say I'm guilty that sometimes I talk about MFIP, and I mean MFIP and DWP, the diversionary work program, but they are two separate pieces. DWP is a program that was, the legislation was passed in 2003, and we actually, counties pretty much started implementing it a year later, which was the deadline. And it's intended to divert the families who are most likely to be able to get jobs into a 4-month temporary program. The months do not count toward the 60 months. The caregiver is required to develop an employment plan before we actually issue any benefit for the family, and for the most part, the benefits are issued via a vendor payment. So if the family has a rent obligation or utilities, those are vendor paid rather than giving the individual the cash, and depending on how much is left, there can be a personal needs allowance based on the individuals in the family. People in DWP are eligible for child care, and they're eligible for food, food support, and they're eligible for health care. The parent is expected to look for work. If individuals don't comply, the case is closed immediately. The financial incentives under DWP for the family are significant to get a job, because if the caregiver gets a job once the cash is approved, or the case is approved, all of those earnings are disregarded during any remaining months in the 4-month period. So it's a bigger disregard than families under MFIP get, because it's meant to be a temporary diversionary program.
Yes. Representative Powell.
Ma'am, what's the success rate? How many people actually go through that 4 months and then not end up on MFIP?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tao, approximately 60% of the families that finish the 4th month don't go on to MFIP, and when we have recently done some analysis, the same families are still not on MFIP in the 12th month. So we think that's about 60% of the families actually use the program, we think, to move into employment. Some cases, and I don't know the exact percentage right now, move on to MFIP because they can move on to MFIP in the 4th month, and those cases then fall under regular MFIP rules.
Okay. And Ms. Sessions, I'm going to have to apologize. I think we're going to have to end here, but we are going to have some legislation, both the governor's proposals and some other proposals dealing with this, and so I think we'd like to have you back to finish this at that time.
Okay.
Thank you very much. We're adjourned, members. Thanks.